Thank you. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you all for being here, but especially to thank the organizers for having invited me. This has really been a workshop unlike any other I think I've attended, and I've been enjoying it, and I think I'm going to be having nightmares about it for months to come, trying to answer some of these questions. Michael already gave away my surprise. I had some very wordy title about coherent effects and something or other, and that was just meant to cover all of the different things that I was hoping might be done in time to talk about when I got here, but of course in the end I came up with something different, amplification of superluminality. I decided I didn't want to concentrate on old work, and I also didn't want to concentrate on some newer work that I started to think was probably wrong. So I should fill the spirit of a workshop and try to tell you about some things that are really just in progress that I've been thinking about largely because of this workshop. Started thinking of a few weeks ago and failed to complete this past week. So please find all the mistakes, the next things I should think about, and I hope we can discuss some interesting things. I'd also, of course, like to thank people that the Berkeley experiments were done with, particularly my advisor, Ray Chow, and also Paul Quiot, and my students at Toronto, in particular, Kevin Resch and Jeff Lundin, who are responsible for a fair bit of the work that I'm going to be showing you.
Now, this is amplification of superluminal pulses, or really of superluminality, like more conferences?
Hopefully both. We'll see. All right, so I lied to you already. I can't resist telling you about some of these things I decided not to talk about. So I'll follow my usual strategy. I'll just talk about them even more quickly than usual. So you may not understand what I'm trying to say, but we can argue about it in the afternoon. I want to tell you a little bit about the very old work on tunneling through multilayer dielectrics. This is stuff you've all probably seen, but I at least want to put up a picture so I can show you my favorite way of looking at the reshaping. Everyone has to have their favorite way of resolving a paradox. But also, I think that this picture is going to be fruitful for thinking about some of what I want to tell you later on. And then I want to tell you about some recent two-photon experiments. This is actually what I was originally planning on talking about here, experiments where we can make nonlinear phase shifts at or near the single photon level. And this is something that got me interested because I began wondering, could you use one photon to control the speed of the second photon? Could we see fast or slow light at the single photon level by using this extra handle? And so far as I can tell, there is an interesting way to do that without just inducing a lot of pulse breakup, but I'm not really sure. We're also interested in that system for quantum computing, and it ran into some problems that made us think a lot about the analogy with electromagnetically induced transparency and slow and stopped light. So something else that I wanted to talk about was some results that we thought we had about slow light and then began to question so much that I decided I can safely put up one slide about it and then move on before anyone jumps on me, but it might provoke some interesting thoughts. I had a funny effect called the Tournois effect that I'll explain when we get to it. But the newer stuff has to do with this amplification of superluminality. The idea is that by adding gain to one of these already superluminal systems, one of these tunneling systems like a multilayer dielectric, we appear to get even larger superluminal effects. And I'm starting to look into whether that enhancement of superluminality could really be useful, could occur without introducing some of the same instabilities or losses that we get in the other systems. That's still a somewhat open question. But to motivate that, I'm going to go through a digression about weak measurements, a way that I think it's fruitful to look at tunneling. And hopefully by the end you'll see that this very strange, abstract-looking theory actually makes interesting predictions and leads us to interesting new systems. All right, so with that rather lengthy outline, let me start zipping superluminally through this set of transparencies. This, of course, is the structure that we tend to study. We don't study square tunneling barriers. In the optical regime, we use these multilayer stacks, just optical mirrors made up by successive Bragg reflections. And this was the first place where we saw superluminal propagation in the optical regime. And the curves look like the curves everyone else has been showing you. Here's a curve, though, where we note that it's possible by tilting these barriers to actually change the sign of the dispersion. Although people think this is a joke, a large part of the motivation for doing this was to convince people who were going to tell us we had just made a sign error in the analysis somewhere. That's easier to do in experiments like this than some people might expect. So Although this is the subluminal case, where what travels through the mirror is shifted to positive times relative to what travels through air, and this is the superluminal case, where the much noisier transmission through the tunnel barrier is shifted to negative times, we figured even if we got it wrong, at least one of them had to be superluminal, so we felt safe in publishing this. Those shifts are a sizable fraction of the, a measurable fraction, I should say, of the pulse width, but we could never really do larger than something like 1/20th of the pulse width in those systems. Now, how do we understand what's going on here? We know, of course, that in these passive systems, you get superluminality when there are things like evanescent waves, when the transmission is less than 100%. And it was early on pointed out, I think in Garrett McCumber's paper, in fact, that this means that no energy is going to appear faster than light, that you're always sitting beneath the tails of the input pulse here at the output. But we were less interested in energy than in information. And there have been a lot of arguments about information and about whether we should talk about analytic pulses or whether we should talk about causal fronts and so forth. And the only point I want to make about information is if we ask ourselves, how does this pulse get reshaped? How over here does the output pulse know that it should look like the peak of a Gaussian, even though it has no information yet about the peak of that Gaussian? A few people have already alluded to this. You can think of it as a Taylor expansion. You can think of it as a derivative. But in the particular experimental situation we're discussing, we see the physical origin for that. There are these many, many layers. Light can travel through and reflect multiply between those different layers. So we just have a sort of discrete set of paths for these waves that we need to add up to calculate the interference. There's some amplitude for the wave to just be transmitted without any reflections. And then there are some pulses that make one pair of reflections, two pairs, four pairs, six pairs, and so on. The way these mirrors are designed, you set those reflections up to be 180 degrees out of phase so that you get destructive interference in transmission, constructive interference in reflection. And if you take these waves and you alternate their signs and you subtract them all from one another, of course, in the steady state, when you see all of these waves together of roughly equal amplitude, you subtract them and you get something close to zero. That's why this thing makes a good mirror. It doesn't transmit much of the light. But at early times, you're going to be dominated by this leading edge because all of these out-of-phase pulses are also delayed in time due to those reflections. Therefore, this destructive interference doesn't work as well at early times. Okay, and that's another way of saying that you always have interference between the charging fields inside the structure and whatever you're trying to send through. But if the structure has a finite bandwidth, it takes a finite time to build up those fields. And you get a transient effect before you've reached the steady state fields, which gives us this apparent superluminality. Now, I think that's a nice, simple picture for classical waves. And of course, you can think about the delta function impulse response, but we've had lots of arguments about whether it makes sense to think about that. I don't want to restart those now. I think this picture is interesting because it's a useful way for us later on to think about the structure with gain. And it took me a while to start understanding why does gain have the effect that it does. I think this picture is going to help us when we get back to that. But that was really an aside, so let me move on to another aside. The next thing that I decided not to tell you about but can't resist is two-photon nonlinear optics. How can I make one photon tell a second photon what to do? And at the simplest level, what I'd like to do is have some magic material here where if I send two photons on this material, one of them is able to stop the other one. It tells the other photon, nope, you can't go through today. And if I get rid of this control photon here, well, then the medium becomes transparent. The other photon is transmitted perfectly well through this switch. That's what we'd like to build. Anyone who knows much about nonlinear optics, well, anyone who knows a little about nonlinear optics, people who know too much might get it right, but people who know a little would say, of course, that's impossible. The interaction between photons is incredibly weak. You need pulses with 10 billion photons to see significant nonlinear effects in any reasonable material. If I only have two photons, the dimensionless efficiency of any such effect will be on the order of 10 to the minus 10. I'm never going to see it. And a good example of that is the process we like to use to create our entangled photons, which is spontaneous parametric downconversion. And this is just a process where I pump a crystal with photons at 2 omega, and I generate pairs of photons at omega. And very often people fail to draw the extra blue line through there, but of course 99.9999999% of the time, all I get is a blue photon that keeps sailing on through here. There's a chance in 10 to the 10 that that blue photon disappears and gives me these two red photons. The interesting thing is that this spontaneous process exists only quantum mechanically. This doesn't exist in the classical theory of nonlinear optics. Now, of course, the time reverse, we always say this is just the time reverse of second harmonic generation. Send in two strong pulses, get out a pulse at 2 omega. Well, of course, harmonic generation is a classical nonlinear wave effect. That does exist in classical electromagnetism. And it occurred to me, not until very few years ago, that I'd been walking around for years, as had many other people, saying, here's a process that exists classically, and here's its time reverse, which exists only quantum mechanically, as though classical electromagnetism was not time reversal invariant. And of course, it is. So what were we forgetting? We were forgetting this blue pulse. If we actually time reverse this system, we don't really just get second harmonic generation. We get a sort of stimulated second harmonic generation. If we send all three of these beams back into the medium, phase conjugated, then when we come out to the left, we will find only blue light. We will find no red light. The interesting thing about this is here we have a system where we may have only two photons, or some small amplitude much less than one to even have two photons. But we will get 100% efficient upconversion of those photons due to interference with the blue beam. It's all an interference effect. But it means that if I had two photons there, I'm sure they're going to upconvert.
So that time reverse process is also completely quantum mechanical, has no classical analog.
Yes and no. Let me show you what we actually do. We don't have a phase conjugate mirror or anything. We just reason what mattered was the phase relationship between those three beams. We don't need to time reverse them. We just need to generate something that looks like the time reverse of that output state.
If I put in three coherent states.
That's what we do. And it doesn't look exactly the same, because what we really wanted was to have either one photon or a pair.
Mal Teich has written that if you start using correlated photons, all your normal scaling laws for nonlinear objects don't hold. Mm-hmm. So if you put in two correlated photons, the efficiency is much, much higher than if you put in two coherent states. Because you need those two photons there simultaneously to generate, to upconvert. Okay?
And
two independent coherent states, then the chances that you have two photons there simultaneously.
Well, can I put
that's a very good point.
I think the difference is you have entanglement between the two photons.
We don't. Okay. At the input, we do not. That's what I'm saying. Okay. We do send in two coherent states. You're right. The efficiency drops down because the probability that I've got photons in both pulses is small.
Right, in practice, you're only post-selecting for coincidences.
Yeah,
take care of it. But Mal Teich would argue that, well, if you did do what you drew, do your down conversion, then take mirrors and send those down converted photons right back into a second crystal, that your efficiency would go way up.
Of course, and that's actually an older experiment by Anton Zeilinger's group. And this is very closely related to his sort of rail cross experiment, with the difference that that looks more like a cavity QED experiment. It's a closed system. You see suppression of down conversion due to this interference in the closed system. We wanted to move to an open system where I could send inputs from some arbitrary, you know, other logic gate, for instance, and see what would happen. But you're right, we send in coherent states that on average have something like 1/100th of a photon per pulse, or have an amplitude of 1/10th to have a photon at all. And what we see is a small modulation in the intensities at the output, but a very large modulation in the coincidence rate.
So can I put it this way? The fact that you're doing coincidence detection post-selects to give you an entangled state at the input.
You could say that. I'm a little worried about the post-selection, because maybe that'll make more sense in the next experiment I'm going to show you. But the point is, that's exactly what we want. We have an input that might contain a photon and might not. And what we want to see is that it switches this one off if there was a photon there. So yes, since there's only a photon here 1/100th of the time, it only switches this off 1/100th of the time. Okay. Anyway, we can talk about this more, but I should, for those of you who haven't.
I think it is an entangled state. We can talk about it. You don't think so?
No.
Well, a photon pair is not necessarily an entangled state already, right?
But they came in common way.
I wouldn't even say that in this particular experiment. Anyway, the experiment is actually to just illuminate a BBO crystal with a pump at 400 nanometers and these two red signals that are highly attenuated to have less than a photon per pulse. These things need to be phase related, so they're all generated from a pulsed TISAF laser, which is doubled to generate the 2 omega. And if you think about the different ways one could get a coincidence count, there are two different processes that could lead to that. One of them is that the pump photon could be down-converted and give me a coincidence count. But the other, and we work very hard to make this nearly indistinguishable from the first one, is that each of these laser beams, coherent states, would happen to have a photon. There's some amplitude for them to have a photon. That amplitude squared tells me the amplitude for a coincidence event. If we make these two amplitudes comparable, we can get interference between them and see a modulation.
I already asked you this question.
Did I answer it last time?
No.
What was the question?
Back to Greece.
Yeah.
But in any event, there's another two. There are two more processes which actually are probably going to give you the phase event. Because if I stare carefully at the two you draw there, they don't have phase relation whatsoever.
Of course they do.
And the other two processes, single photon interfering, producing coincidence between one photon, between the photons, one being detected and another not, with together with the coherent state.
Let me answer what I think you're saying, and if I got it wrong, let's come back to it after the talk. But certainly there is phase coherence between these two, because the phase of the pump beam, which is the second harmonic of my laser, is 2 phi, if phi is the phase coming out of my laser. The phase of a photon pair here is 2 phi, because there are two photons. Now, you're right that there's a classical nonlinear optical effect that occurs here, which is that since I have the pump and this signal coming in, I can get optical parametric amplification of the signal, which will then generate a very small field in the idler. It's a tiny field. It would be immeasurably small in this case. But I'm also introducing this additional beam over here. And the oscillation that I generate here can interfere with that beam. And that gives me some classical modulation in the singles rate. It's on the order of 1% in this experiment. What's not classical is the fact that the coincidence rate can have arbitrarily high, arbitrarily close to unity modulation, because what I'm doing to the photon pairs is different and not describable by classical theory.
How do you generate your two coherent states that you inject? Do you take some of your pump light, down-convert it?
No.
I
wasn't going to show this, but I was worried someone would ask. We have a TISAF laser. Actually, this is for a more complicated experiment. Ignore the upper arm. And we pick a very, very small amount off at a beam splitter, and it's still too much, and we attenuate it greatly.
Those are your classical states, but then you generate by second harmonic generation.
And then by second harmonic generation, we generate the blue pump. That's right.
I see, but they have during the second harmonic generation, in a weak measurement sense, you are preconditioning that pump wave. You're slightly modifying the statistics of that blue beam.
You mean of the red beams? It's certainly true that when I see a coincidence count, I'm only looking at a case where there happen to be two photons in the TISAF beam. I'm throwing away any single photon events, either at the stage of coincidence detection or earlier at the stage of second harmonic generation. But yeah, you can tell every laser physicist that when they do second harmonic generation, they're generating entangled states by post-selecting on photon pairs going into their doubling crystal. I don't think it really modifies the interpretation of the experiment.
But since they have a common source, the second harmonic is due to annihilation of a pair of photons.
Yeah, but they're uncorrelated because he's put that beam splitter there. So the photons that are going out that are part of this probability putting in the crystal are uncorrelated with the...
Yeah, I mean, it's just coherent state, coherent state, coherent state. It happens that the only way we can get phase coherence experimentally is to have a common source, right? But, you know, if we had one of Ted Hensch's magic sources and, you know, I could actually build separate
measures. I understand this from Feynman's point of view. I don't know whether the pairs went to the...
Of course. It's just an interferometer for photon pairs.
Yeah, exactly.
Where in one path they turn blue and turn red again, and in the other they don't. That's all it is.
Instead of putting a band, a filter there that filters out the red line after the second harmonic generation, what if you were to pull off the residual red light after it went through the second harmonic generation and use that for your probes, then I think there might, yeah. there probably would be, there might be an enhancement in your count rates, because then at the photon level, they really do have additional correlations that they build up.
They're very small, since you know only one part in billions is being removed from the beam. It's an interesting question. In practical terms, we didn't do that because the focusing onto the second harmonic crystal distorts the beam so much that the red we get out is nearly unusable. But we could get around that with some spatial filtering. No, it's an interesting question whether we'd get additional correlations if we used correlated
instruments. Because the total correlations you see are incredibly tiny. So
in singles, not in coincidence.
In coincidences,
these aren't even the best data that we have. We've seen as high as 60% visibility in coincidences. We don't know why we can't get 100. I mean, you're.
But the total pairs out of the total number of photons that are coming in there is incredibly tiny.
Out of the total number of photons.
So even you were saying you were discounting the idea of putting this light that after went through the crystal. You said it's a really tiny effect, but what you're looking at are really tiny effects. So you may get a doubling or something like that.
If you mean something like a doubling, yeah, maybe.
Yeah. So since you were looking at a really weak.
Except
it's not even the bunch of pairs already. So you're left over with the ones which are
the singles.
No, I don't think that's true because it's not as though the doubling crystal uh-huh. converts pairs with unit efficiency. Right. It's actually a coherent state with a mean photon number of 10 billion. And sometimes it removes two. I just think the modification to that state is so small, right? You want your small effect relative to another small effect, not relative to the huge coherent state.
So why can't you get the visibility of 100%?
Because the two different paths are distinguishable, right? Isn't that always the answer? We don't know which degree of freedom is making them distinguishable. Obviously, it's very sensitive to polarization. It's very sensitive to the spatial mode. The biggest problem we had in these experiments is to realize that entanglement is now the worst thing in the world. Because we have a photon pair from two independent laser beams or a photon pair from a down conversion crystal. This one is entangled. This one isn't. So entanglement is now a type of information. If I ask, is the photon pair entangled or not, I can tell what its source is. Uh-huh. So we actually need to work hard to get rid of the entanglement. So in order to do that, we want to project our entangled state onto a product state, which just means we project it onto a single mode, a single spatial mode, a single temporal spectral mode, because you can't have anything but a product state in a one-dimensional Hilbert space, right? So that means we have to spatially filter, we have to narrow band filter, and building good spatial filters that still pass a fair amount of our down-converted light through has been a trick. We eventually switched to a fiber optical system, thinking a single mode fiber will do this better, we'll finally get above 60%. Everything got worse. Apparently that wasn't the problem. Oh. We're now back to around 50%. But I don't know what the remaining problem is. It's very likely some complicated kind of temporal correlations because we're using not quite transform limited femtosecond pulses. They're going through a lot of dispersive media. We haven't measured everything perfectly at every stage. And I suspect there's still some distinguishing information in the time domain, which if we had the necessary count rate, we could get rid of by filtering even more narrowly. But we haven't been successful yet. Experimental problem, I think.
Is this due to some kind of decoherence? This loss of visibility?
I don't think so. But
you can't be
it
sure.
would be exciting if it were, yeah. I don't know what to compare it to,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
If we could find the magic medium that made things worse, well, it seems to be anything, actually. Each time we try to fix it, it gets worse, you know? But So that sounds like decoherence. Maybe you've got a point. We should write it up that way.
What's the ratio between the two paths in terms of intensity?
In terms of intensity or in terms of coincidence count rate?
Intensity. Are they roughly 1-to-1?
Oh, sorry, the two red paths. Or the red and the blue.
I mean, as you said, there are two possibilities. One correlated pair being detected.
Those two paths are arranged to be 1-to-1. We get about 3 coincidence counts a second from down conversion. We get about 3 coincidence counts a second from the laser beams. But that's by design. Well, the intensity ratios are huge. We have a tenth of a photon per pulse in the red beam, or a hundredth of a photon per pulse in the red beam, and we have a billion photons per pulse in the blue beam.
No, I mean in the laser pulse compared to your non-converted beam.
That's exactly what I mean.
And so those are very.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. No, to the down-converted pulse. The laser pulse is still probably about 1,000 times more intense. than the down-converted false, because it's not entangled, because I need to get the same coincidence rate from uncorrelated things rather than from correlated things. So you're correct. I forget if it's 1,000 or 10,000. I've got the numbers back in a paper in the office, though. All right. Let me just quickly say that there's one thing we know this is useful for. We're working really hard to figure out, are there ways we can do quantum information processing with this? And I'll show you one extension. But there's at least an interesting quantum paradox where I think this is exactly the way to go. About 10 years ago, Lucian Hardy proposed this brilliant paradox based on Ezio and Weidman's interaction-free measurements. Those of you who have seen these will realize if I set up a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, like this green interferometer, where all of the particles going in come out the bright port, as soon as I place any object in one of the arms of the interferometer, I start seeing some clicks at the dark port. Not all the time, but occasionally I'll get a count at the dark port and immediately conclude, hey, there must have been something blocking this path, because that's what destroyed the interference. I can conclude that even though no particle was absorbed in the dark path. So this is something that's generated a lot of interest. But Hardy asked, if this is really interaction free, then what if I had a quantum particle that was maybe blocking this path and maybe somewhere else? I do a measurement on that, I must disturb it. And he came up with this clever idea. Imagine an electron that goes through this interferometer, and a positron that, after a positron beam splitter, may or may not block the electron path. And he asked, what would happen? Do I destroy the coherence when I measure where the positron is? Well, obviously, if I want to answer that, I have to look for coherence, so I bring these two beams back together, and suddenly you realize I've built a very, very symmetric situation. Each particle has its own Mach-Zehnder. I assume that if they collide here, they're guaranteed to annihilate. That's the theory paper. And I can think of either particle as doing an interaction-free measurement on the other particle. If I see a positron here, I know the electron was in the input in the in path. If I see the electron here, I know the positron was in this path. Therefore, he concluded, since the electron and the positron would annihilate if they were both in that path, I should never see both this detection and this detection. If both particles show up in the dark ports, that tells me that both other particles were in the bomb path and annihilated. Well, if you work it out quantum mechanically, you find that's just wrong. You do sometimes see detections at these two places, which violates a certain kind of contrafactual reasoning. And I think it's an interesting paradox about quantum mechanics, except I don't know how to build this interferometer. And now, of course, we know how to build the interferometer. We're building two optical interferometers, and where they overlap, we're putting our little near-unit efficiency up conversion so that our two photons will annihilate. So at least I can point to one experiment that we weren't able to do before that now we can do. So that's my canonical example, that there is something useful we can already do with two-photon nonlinear optics. There are some interesting conclusions you can draw from that experiment if you analyze it with weak measurements, and that's the next phase of what we want to do. But since I'm already going to be running out of time, I won't tell you about that during the talk. I'll just tell you quickly, there's an extension of this. We asked, if we can have this absorptive nonlinearity, couldn't we also have a dispersive nonlinearity? Couldn't we somehow detune from the absorption and see dispersion instead? And eventually we realized it's even simpler than that. So this is the experiment. We build, again, a Mach-Zehnder interferometer for some very weak beam. And then we ask, by putting this pumped crystal in one arm of the interferometer, can I induce a phase shift on the beam that passes through it that depends on whether or not there's a photon in the control beam? And it turns out very simply that, of course, I can. The process is that I showed you earlier, if I look at the complex amplitude for there to be a photon pair, had two terms. It had my local oscillators, my two laser beams, and the down conversion, and I arranged them to interfere destructively, okay, to give me no coincidence counts. But if I just arrange them a little differently, then instead of destructive interference, I can impress a phase shift that depends on the presence of a control photon. And this was just published quite recently. We observe that phase shift if we compare the phase coming out of the Mach-Zehnder interferometer when there was a control photon, which we have to post-select, to when there wasn't. It's very noisy data, but the fit is actually quite good. We see that this blue curve observed when there is no other photon is very significantly shifted relative to the red curve observed when there is a second photon. So this is cross-phase modulation for single photons. And if those data aren't quite convincing, you can see we did it for a number of different pump parameters. And the phase shifts that we see as a function of input phase follow theory with no adjustable parameters really quite well.
So this is all post-selected? you cannot with certainty put in one photon and make a phase shift.
That's exactly the problem that I want to come to, right? This depends on the pump phase shift. That's what this graph is. So it means it's an interference effect. I have to send in things with a definite phase relationship to make this do what I want. A single photon does not have a definite phase. So I can't send in a Fock state and see this effect. I need to send in a coherent state with a well-defined phase, and then later on ask, did that coherent state happen to have a photon in it? Which is a question that people always yell at me and say that doesn't mean anything, but of course that's what we do. We put a detector there. If you know there's a coherent state coming in, but you know you detected a photon at the end, then you see this effect. But it has to be done in post-selection. Like a lot of the down conversion experiments on entangled states, on Bell state generation, and so forth.
No, but I would argue with the Fock state that if you had an M photon Fock state, that your measurement of the first photon starts to act back and select a phase from that Fock state. And it's no longer, it then very quickly.
Only if your detector has an uncertainty in photon number. For instance, if you take that n-photon Fock state and you beat it against a homodyne, then you can start generating a phase. But otherwise, it doesn't work. It's like these questions of interfering Bose condensates.
Yeah, right.
You know, if you no longer know where the photon came from, then you can start generating a phase. Well, we've been playing with this, and we'd like to come up with ways that you could use this as a conditional phase gate for quantum information. But this problem of not being able to use arbitrary inputs is obviously bothering us. We did show that you can use it in a certain sense with down-converted Bell states to do complete Bell state determination. We can distinguish the four Bell states using this nonlinearity. We cannot do a projective measurement onto one of the four Bell states because the absolute phase starts to matter. If you tell me I'm going to give you one of these four Bell states, but I'm going to tell you what its phase is relative to the vacuum, because I generated it in a down conversion crystal anyway, I can tell you which one of the four you generated. But if you give me some other state, you want to do quantum teleportation and want me to do a projective measurement, I can't do it. And again, I'd be happy to come back to that at a blackboard later on, but it's too long a story to go into right now. We naturally began comparing this to some of the other schemes people talk about for these things, such as slow light and fast light, because the analogy seemed very strong, that by using one strong pump beam, we were able to modify the properties of the medium so that it seemed to have a strong effective nonlinearity for the other beams, but that this was all due to interference. And for a while, we had ourselves convinced that EIT would always have the same problems that we do about this absolute phase question. And now I'm a little confused about it, and there's one theorem we were able to prove, and I don't know if maybe there's a mistake in the theorem. I don't think so. I think more likely other people already recognize the content of the theorem and it's nothing new. So I'll just put up one slide and tell you what we found and you can tell me whether you think it's interesting or not. If we try to make a three-level electromagnetically induced transparency system, the kind that one might want to use in quantum logic, and we want it to be able to work for unentangled inputs, that seems like a reasonable constraint. You don't want to need your inputs to be entangled for your logic gate to work. And we want to leave the inputs in a pure state. In other words, we don't want decoherence to occur, so we don't want these inputs to remain entangled with the atoms after they go through. That would not be a good thing for a quantum logic gate. The only way to have EIT work properly, to have no absorption, is for both inputs to be in coherent states. Very much like in our system, we can have coherent state come in, and they do something funny when they come out, but we could not have two Fock states, M and N, come in and leave with some phase shift that depended only on M and N without getting entangled with the atoms. We could not build a conditional phase gate this way.
What are the two modes here? Are they control and signal modes, or how are they?
You can think of them as control and signal. You can think of them symmetrically as just two qubits going through a C naught or a C phase.
Yes.
But they're the two modes that interact with these two transitions.
It's a linear interaction.
Unitary.
It's a unitary interaction.
That seems to be related to the standard phase of beam splitters. I
mean, exactly. That's how you prove this. This is identical to a beam splitter.
That's actually it was proven by Adi Lam a long time ago.
Uh-huh. That's good to hear. For a long time, we sat there saying, "Oh, look, we've reduced it to the problem of a beam splitter," and I'm sure this is in all our textbooks, but we couldn't find the proof.
Adi Lam.
Adi Mann.
Adi Mann.
Adi Mann. So it's, yeah, I believe you that it's a well-known result for beam splitters, but I'd like to get the reference from you later anyway. The question is what it really means for quantum information in this case. And it's all of these questions about doing things adiabatically, the kinds of things that happen in the stoplight case that still leave me a little confused. Maybe the adiabaticity means it's possible to generate entanglement with the atoms, but then adiabatically get rid of it again so you're okay again by the end of the day.
And you assume pure Fock states going in?
No, we've proved in general that they need to be coherent states going in. So Fock states are just one counterexample.
Yeah, but any pulse Fock state is not, well, it's not no longer Fock state. It's a mixed state that you can expand in terms of coherent states.
What?
I'd still call it a Fock state, no. But this is a single mode treatment anyway. We have certainly not gone.
If I try to make a pulse, yeah. I try to localize my. Mandel showed years ago that that's not a Fock state.
No, but the.
Wait,
I'm confused. I think there's definitely, there's this attaching model to the curve nonlinearity in a shape 4 level system. So if you allow another level, I mean, if you allow the two Fock states not to be plane wave modes, but let's say pulse modes system, then your requirement is that the output are two pure modes again. So what I mean,
that the state of these two modes be pure. In other words, not be entangled with the atoms. I don't ask anything about entanglement with each other, of course. We want to be able to generate entanglement.
Yeah, but do you also require that the mode purity is conserved? What I'm asking for is the following. If you have a sentient pulse, which you could consider as to be a single mode of a non-plane wave, then you can have a conditional phase shift, but then the output will not be.
Oh, so instead of being entangled with the atoms, I'll end up entangled with the spatial degrees of freedom of the light or something.
One submanifold and another submanifold.
That's interesting. We haven't extended beyond the simple two-mode case, so I can't address that.
But what you're saying is given two input modes to output modes.
That's right.
Yes. Okay.
That's right.
This can be very easily seen from the conservation point, that we are switching end-to-end in two modes.
No. No. Look at the output here. I didn't assume a controlled knot. I assumed a controlled phase gate. There's no conservation problem. I've got M and N. I have M and N. Same energy.
They can't be off the same mode. Otherwise, they're indistinguishable. They're off different modes. The physical parameters, either polarization or energy or whatever.
No, I'm assuming the photon number hasn't changed in either mode. All I'm getting is a global phase. That's what the controlled phase gate does. So that raises some either open or long ago closed and hence forgotten questions. I'm not sure which, but it's something that we want to keep thinking about. So let's see. I'm going to run out of time, of course, before I get up to what I really wanted to talk about. But still, one quick story. There's a well-known to laser physicist interferometer called a Giles-Tournois interferometer. And very recently in the IEEE Journal of Quantum Electronics, one of the co-inventors of this thing decided to think about the delay when you reflect off it. And he argued that you get a negative group delay time for reflection, even though the reflection probability is 100%, and this thing is passive. The Giles-Tournois interferometer is just a Fabry-Perot, but a Fabry-Perot whose back reflector has 100% reflectivity, which means that eventually all the light is going to be reflected because there is only one output port. Nevertheless, it has all the interesting phase properties of a regular Fabry-Perot, which makes it useful for pulse compression and things like that. What he found, though, is that if you embed this in a medium and you come in beyond the critical angle for total internal reflection at this very first interface, what he calls a frustrated Giles-Tournois interferometer.
Sorry, say that slowly again.
This is inside another medium, so that even the entrance into the interferometer is impossible. It's beyond the critical angle for total internal reflection. Okay. You
N1
still
has
get
to be greater than N2, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay. That's right. You still get evanescent waves in here that undergo some interference because the evanescent waves are reflected. This is a finite thickness layer. And he calculated that the reflection time was going to be less than zero, which we, of course, decided was going to violate causality.
What is the reference again? Can you read it?
Yeah, it's the IEEE Journal of Quantum Electronics, volume 33. 1997, and I don't have the page number here, but I have it. I have the reference back in the office. Page number isn't up there. Volume 11, number 4, though. Anyway, I had a new master's student, and I told him, look, if this is true, it would be a beautiful experiment. We should be able to do this. First, it's got to be wrong. Show me why it's wrong. And when he couldn't do that, I showed him why it had to be wrong, why it violated causality. And I told him, well, if you can't show that he's wrong, then show that I'm wrong. But we can't both be right. And well, he was an interesting graduate student. After a while, he came back to me. One of the problems is that Tournois is an engineer. He uses a different sign convention for I. And every time I try to reproduce his results, at some point I get confused about the sign. And my student had the same problem. And you know, once he wrote e to the I phi, and I said, no, in the convention you're using now, that's e to the minus I phi. And he said, well, that doesn't really matter. And I said, well, you're looking for a sign error. You know, Chris, the sign probably does matter. So he said, oh, OK. And he wrote minus e to the I phi. And I spent the next 10 minutes convincing him that that wasn't equal to e to the minus I phi. So he didn't stay with me very long. And sadly, he now has a very successful career in a photonics company. Don't know how that, he's the only person I know who hasn't been laid off, actually. He seems to fit that environment. Well, we eventually figured out both why it's right and why it's wrong. His prediction is correct. He's a smart guy. And we'd like to do the experiment. We started to. The shift is very small. It has to be less than 1 over omega. That's an absolute maximum. So, you know, 0.2 or 0.3 femtoseconds. So we built a system.
Do it in the, where's the Masao? Do it in the electronic circuits.
All right. You'll show me how to build this Yerkes Tournois later.
I'll show you how. Yeah.
If you remember, Linz reported an empirical rule that the maximum advance time you get is always in the order of
Yeah, right. So there's a tremendous advantage of doing things at the very low frequency.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, the empirical rule is dimensional analysis, right? We sort of know that has to be true. Anyway, we've started the experiment, but yeah, maybe you're right that a different system is smarter because we're having obviously all sorts of systematic errors at the same level, and that's why we have no experimental results. We also figured out why it doesn't violate causality. Like many people, Tournois decided to simplify this and to take out the second degree of freedom in a two-dimensional problem and really just treat the one-dimensional problem. The earliest treatments of tunneling times through prism pairs do the same thing. Even Mandel's work looks at the delay time directly opposite the point of entry. But we all know that upon total internal reflection, there's a spatial shift known as the Gaussian shift. The peak of the pulse comes out at a different spatial position. And we can't neglect that, as actually Ray and I pointed out in the tunneling case in about 94. If you think about what's going on here, you have some Gaussian pulse, very sticky, some Gaussian pulse coming in with some width here, some Gaussian pulse coming out with some width here. What Tournois calculates by the method of stationary phase is the time at which the field at this point reaches its maximum. And I contend that that's just the wrong question to answer. I want to know at what time the peak leaves the surface. Well, the peak doesn't necessarily leave the surface when this reaches a maximum, because the peak never leaves that point, it leaves this point. So if I graph the field here, he's right, I'll see a negative delay time, but I'll never see 100% reflection at that point, because the maximum never leaves that spatial position. The maximum leaves this spatial position, and if I look there, I'll see a positive delay time and 100% reflectivity. And it's easy enough to show that graphically. If you just look at the time they calculated, as I said, it can't be greater than 1 over omega. That's easy to prove. And if you look at the time due to the Gaussian shift, this is 1 over omega. This is the Gaussian shift. So this is obviously going to be dominant. We're always going to end up with a total positive time. And this obvious inequality took us about 3 months to prove and is some incredibly ugly paper filled with trigonometry. And there's got to be a simpler way, but we just couldn't find it. Anyway, it's easy enough to show if you spend 3 months, that this really does have to have a total positive.
So, let's see, so associated with Gaussian, is there always such a time shift, Gaussian time shift?
Yeah, there is. That's also in our 94 paper, and it's very easy to see. It has nothing to do with what goes on inside the medium. If I just calculate the time of arrival at this point, right across from the point of entry. Ignore the fact that I forgot to include the Gaussian shift there. And I have parallel wavefronts propagating out in this direction. It only takes trigonometry to figure out at what time the peak here reaches a maximum. Right? It's just the time it takes this wavefront to propagate that far. So you can go directly from the Gaussian shift and the index and the final medium and the angle to an extra delay time. All right, so I promised I would tell you about weak measurements, but I lied to you. Too many interesting discussions. Weak measurements are a way that Aharonov and his co-workers proposed to think about post-selected ensembles. In the case of tunneling, what this means to me is if I know that I have a particle coming into a square barrier, and I only care about the tunneling particles, I care about the particles that I eventually see over here, and I want to ask some question, like how long did they take, or how much time do they spend in the barrier, I can't seem to do that with standard quantum measurement, because something like the position operator at this time doesn't commute with the projection onto the transmitted state over here. That's the way the theorists put it, and I even confused myself when I said it. A simpler down-to-earth way of saying it is if I measure where the particle is now, I change the state, I collapse it. If I find it in the barrier, I actually give it enough energy to be in the barrier, and it's no longer tunneling. After that, it does something different, and the ensemble I'm looking at is not the ensemble that would have tunneled if I hadn't made this measurement. So the idea of weak measurements is to learn how to measure things with huge uncertainties, but also very small back action. So they leave the thing that you're measuring nearly unchanged. And then statistically, you can repeat this many times, as we always do in the lab, and find some statistical properties of what's going on. Find, on average, how much time did the particles that were transmitted spend in the middle. And there's some math that's actually surprisingly simple if you wave your hands fast enough that gives you a very nice expression. But if you graph it for transmission through a square barrier, let me just show you what you see. This is a movie, not of psi squared, not of the probability distribution of a tunneling particle, but of the conditional probability, the probability that a particle is at x at some given time, given that I know eventually I'm going to see it transmitted on the far side of the barrier. I'm going to post-select my measurements on the transmitted particles. And at very early times, I just see my wave packet approaching the barrier. And after a while, I see some self-interference, just like I do for psi squared. But you notice I also start seeing self-interference on the far side. And as I go further and further in time, the packet eventually reconstitutes itself on the far side and moves entirely away to the right. Now, that shouldn't be surprising either, because once I detect it on the right, I can say pretty well, well, an instant ago it must have been almost at my detector. It wasn't magically back on the other side of the world. The two things that I found surprising when I did this analysis are we're always talking about how the peak is reconstituted from the leading edge of the input pulse. That's why I did this. I wanted to see, let me show you that when the particle's transmitted, I can tell you it was already in the leading edge before it got to my barrier. And that's just not true. This looks exactly like the incidence peak, and it's not at all biased towards the leading edge before it comes in. Perhaps more interesting is that this function never gets big inside the barrier. It's always exponentially decaying from both edges of the barrier, and it's exponentially small at x equals 0. So this particle, which appeared on the far side of the barrier, would in some sense almost never be observed in the middle of the barrier, even though I know it got through. And again, I could talk a lot more about that, but the one thing that I should point out is that that quantity, that time, is not a real number. It turns out to be a complex number, and we thought a lot about how to interpret that. It's actually Marcus Butiker I think it was Rolf Landauer. Both of them had the same objection. I think it was Landauer who wrote, "This is ridiculous. Has anyone ever seen a stopwatch with complex numbers on the dial?" That's actually the wrong question to ask, in my opinion. You could make a stopwatch with complex numbers on the dial. It doesn't matter, right? That's just how you treat your data. The problem is that I want access to both of those dimensions. And what I need to do is think of the hand of the stopwatch as being something quantum mechanical. It's not some classical position. It's some object in some wave function. That wave function is going to be Gaussian if we're simple-minded. And what I mean by a measurement result is that the centroid of this Gaussian should shift by some amount that tells me the value of the measured quantity. So I want e to the minus x squared over 4 sigma squared to go to e to the minus x minus t, where this isn't really meant to be time. It's meant to be the measured quantity, right? The time I'm trying to measure. And if this T is complex, that's still a perfectly valid wave function. And what weak measurement tells us is the complex number goes into that wave function, suitably renormalized. The real part tells me the spatial shift. And funnily enough, the imaginary time tells me about a momentum kick. And all we're realizing is that there's always back action in quantum measurements, and that this simplistic model of classical measurements where I can think only about position is unfair. Anything that interacts with position also interacts with momentum. And it's a negligible effect in the classical regime. But when we do quantum measurements, we can't just ask about the peak position of our pointer. We also have to worry about the momentum, about the conjugate variable in general. So this is something that we're trying to start looking for experimentally. But in the meantime,
you might emphasize that weak values are always complex.
Well, they're in general complex, but you can make them either real or imaginary, as a matter of fact. I wasn't thinking about this so much in the context of tunneling anymore. That work is several years old. Until I received an email. It's actually Mohammed Mojahedi who forwarded me an email from Tony Siegman, who seems to be polling a lot of people about the following interesting question. What happens if you put an amplifier in a forbidden region? Try to amplify an evanescent wave. So specifically, the question he posed in the email was, is it possible to have a single interface between two dielectrics, one of them purely dispersive, but one of them with gain? Are there any values of N1 and the real part and imaginary part of N2 that will give me a Fresnel reflection coefficient greater than 1? Which we would interpret as saying that there's an evanescent wave, in the case where I'm beyond total internal reflection, which he thought might be the logical case where you'd look for this, you'd have an evanescent wave here that could get amplified, but would have to feed that amplification back into the reflected beam. I still don't know the answer to this. I think the answer is yes. I've done some just back of the envelope stuff that says it should be yes. My students think it should be yes. And in Tony's email, he showed a few people had voted, and everyone had voted yes, except for Tony himself. So I'm starting to think he knows something that the rest of us don't. But
this actually came up in the context of Ken Pendry's discussion. Someone, he amplifies evanescent waves to get these.
Oh,
he focuses,
yeah.
Someone,
yeah,
asked him, well, can you? I think Joe Eberle asked him, can you use an amplifier? And he's looked at that.
He's looked at it?
Yes. So that's theoretically. So apparently, he would be on the side of.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. It seems straightforward enough, but it made me think more in general. What happens when you put amplification in a forbidden region? What are the effects? And this reminded me of the weak measurement stuff, because another calculation I had done at the time was to try to show that that had some physical significance. So I said, what are different ways we might do something like a weak measurement if we can't do a real weak measurement? And one example that actually some solid state physicists had considered long before, it turns out, was, imagine my multilayer structure. Let me put a scatterer or a partial absorber somewhere inside that structure and ask, how much does that affect the transmission? That's sort of a way of measuring how strongly it interacted with the absorber. And as a function of where I put the absorber, I found some interesting things. In the tunneling case, this black line tells you how sensitive the transmission is to the absorber. The dashed line shows you how sensitive the reflection is to the absorber. So the reflection isn't surprising at all. If I put an absorber near the beginning of this multilayer structure, my beam sees that before getting reflected, and of course it's attenuated. If I put it all the way on the far side of a mirror that the reflected light never got through, then of course that has no effect on the reflection. But in transmission, I see exactly the curve that we would expect from that weak measurement argument. I see that an absorber near the beginning certainly hurts transmitted light. An absorber near the end also hurts the transmitted light. That's where it had to come from. But surprisingly enough, an absorber placed in the middle has a very, very small effect on the value of the transmission.
That's kind of the standard trick that people use for making X-ray mirrors, to figuring out where the field should or should not be. And you put the absorbing layers where you expect the field to be small.
Oh, okay, for a mirror. It surprises me more in transmission than for a mirror.
Well,
because somehow it's actually getting through that.
What you're making is a mirror. You're looking at tunneling, right?
But I'm looking at the transmission.
Sure.
Yeah.
But still the same thing is going to apply, because if you put the metal in the wrong place, nothing gets reflected, nothing gets transmitted.
That's right.
It turns into heat. So they're making a good mirror that reflects. So I'm assuming that the total energy dissipated in the mirror is smaller, so you're going to have an increased transmission.
It's, in this case, it doesn't increase the transmission. Well, I mean, to lowest order, it leaves the transmission unchanged, which I still find surprising. You're certainly right that there's going to be less dissipation if you put it with a field.
Just where is the field, or in your case, where is the probability, and you want to put something that absorbs in regions where you don't.
But I'm not just minimizing the dissipation. It's a little different from thinking about where is the field, because we're doing this post-selection. Mm-hmm. So I'm asking about the field that corresponds to those particles that are going to be transmitted, as opposed to the one for the reflected. So, for instance, if you go to the above resonance case, you can start mapping out mode functions, and you find exactly what you expect. You get more loss if you put your absorber at the peak of the mode. But you find different curves depending on whether you want to leave the transmission alone or the reflection alone. In some sense, they come from different parts of that mode.
Yeah. I was just going to say on that question you had where it was just simple, two regions, one being the amplifier and one's vacuum.
Yeah.
I've at least looked at the case when you have an absorber on the one side, and the interesting thing, at least it was interesting to me, was to notice that inside the absorber you get a superposition of a regular kind of wave going as attenuating as it's traveling, but also this evanescent looking wave superimposed inside there.
So yeah, that sounds mathematically very similar to what we see. Anyway, when I was thinking about the gain, I realized, well, okay, I'll try to wrap up. That's not so different from the absorption case, but what's interesting is this imaginary part of the weak value that I alluded to. If your pointer is the particle number, right, you know, an absorption or gain, that's basically the pointer. What's the conjugate variable? The conjugate variable to number is phase. So when I'm in the center of the barrier and I'm not affecting the number that's transmitted, instead I'm affecting the phase. Putting this absorber in was going to change the phase and presumably then the delay time of the transmission. And I never actually finished the calculation, but just sort of out of hand waving, I said it's going to slow the thing down. But now I realize maybe if you put gain in there, it'll have the opposite effect and speed the wave up. So that was the motivation to look at this, and I still don't fully understand the problem, but I have numerical calculations, and it does seem to be true, and I need to think about it more, and I'd like more input about it. But this is for a 9-layer dielectric, not a very high Q, and with no gain at all, you see some superluminal tunneling here, and over at the resonant transmission points, you see the Q of the cavity. You see a storage time related to the ring down time of the cavity. If you add some gain in the mid-gap region, so right in the middle of the barrier where the light isn't supposed to get anyway, you put an amplifier, you find that the transmission amplitude isn't changed very much, but suddenly the transmission delay time changes a lot. And you start getting enhanced superluminality down here. This is down to about 5 femtoseconds from, I guess, a little over 6 over there. And on resonance, because of the gain, you get an enhanced Q, so you get an even longer ring down time. So this is frequency, and this is delay time in seconds. So about 12 femtoseconds would be D over C in this case. And at the peak here, you're traveling at something close to 2C. That's just the tunneling case we did. And you can get it closer to 2.5 or 3C by adding a very small amount of gain. And you can do better by adding more gain, but eventually you get some funny points where you actually get zero or negative times. I think these are just related to going through threshold. I think they're probably unphysical solutions. And again, I need to limit this and look at what happens if you're careful not to go beyond threshold. The interesting thing is that the gain is only in the region the light isn't supposed to get. So it's not going to go over threshold at this point in the mid-gap. The transmission there is not changing. We don't have an instability there. It's not due to the naive flat gain model that I used there. If instead you use a Lorentz model gain medium, you can see that as you go to broader and broader, as you go to bigger and bigger damping, you eventually retrieve exactly what you get from the flat model. And we end up increasing the speed at the middle of the gap from 1.9C to 2.5C. The transmission only changes from 10% to 11% as we do that. So I think this is another way of doing gain-assisted superluminality, using gain to increase...
Broadband
gain in this case, that's right. But hopefully to do it without introducing the same kinds of instabilities. So... I won't show you all my other graphs because I've taken up too much time. I've got lots of other plots. I don't even know what order to put them in because I'm still so confused about the problem. But you do find that the time delay decreases monotonically with the gain that you put in, asymptotically approaching zero. Never does seem to go negative. It keeps decreasing towards zero. But I don't know how far one should look at that curve, because somewhere before you reach zero, instabilities will show up, and I haven't yet calculated exactly where. So, in summary, I told you a bunch of things. We can do nonlinear optics at the single photon level. Also arguing that coherence effects in quantum information may be subtle. We've got to worry about these number phase questions. Two-dimensional effects can also be subtle, as in that case of the Giotto-Noir interferometer. And one thing I'm really arguing now is that these weak measurements are not just a mathematical curiosity. They can really teach us how to think about a system, how to think about different experimental modifications of a system, and what they'll see. But practically speaking, I think it's interesting to explore the combination of the old superluminality due to tunneling and the newer gain-assisted superluminality, and see if somewhere combining those two things can give us better superluminal effects with less problems of attenuation or noise or instability or so forth. But we still need to think about exactly why this works. If you noticed, I guessed this was going to be true because of weak measurements, and the simple physical model for why it happens is on its way. We can talk about it in private, but I'm interested to hear other people's ideas too. Thanks for your attention.